Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now with today's topic, here is James White.
And good evening and welcome to The Dividing Line, a special edition of The Dividing Line this evening, live on Thursday evening if you're listening on Saturday. Yes, we record this on Thursday evening because I'm going to be out of town on Saturday doing a men's retreat up in Prescott, Arizona. So we thought we would take care of The Dividing Line early. We had things we wanted to share with everybody and had some things wanted to play for everybody and get a little bit of your reaction to. And so that's exactly what we're going to do this evening. And so we would invite your participation. I don't know how much participation we're going to be able to have this evening, but we will be taking phone calls a little bit later on if time allows us to do so. We just got back from our semi-annual outreach in Salt Lake City, Utah, and over the past number of years, that outreach has taken on a new characteristic to it in the sense that up until 2.5-3 years ago, we only passed out tracts and, well, I'll take that back. We had done some work in the sense of doing some radio programs and things like that, but that was pretty much just myself staying later after everybody else had already left. But start a couple of years ago, we began doing some debates on the Friday night before the general conference. The first was with a former Baptist who had become a Roman Catholic, and then all the rest of them have been on the subject of Mormonism with authors and professors from Brigham Young University. And this time we did a debate with Martin Tanner. He's an attorney, a graduate of Brigham Young Law School, and he is the host of a radio program, I think it's on KSL now, up in Salt Lake City itself. And he and I had done a number of radio debates before, and this discussion was on the issue of deification. So that's become a part of the ministry, but the distribution of tracts and sharing with Mormons outside of the convention has changed a lot over the past number of years. Specifically, what has taken place is, first, we had the opening of what we call the Meganacle. And the Meganacle, the very large meeting house across the street from the north gate of Temple Square, has changed the dynamic of the ministry, because up until that point, the meetings took place in the Mormon Tabernacle. The Mormon Tabernacle was on a, back when we first started this anyways, was in a situation where there were only three gates that people could go through, other than the leadership of the church itself, to get to the general conference. They had to go through the north gate, the south gate, or the west gate. Now, that then changed when they opened the east gate, and then that changed when they purchased the land over there and basically found a way to get people in from at least the Joseph Smith building across the street without crossing, allegedly, public property. That whole issue is still up in the air as far as whether that's going to remain a no free speech zone. But anyways, then at that time, you know, you could, with a fairly small number of people, pretty much cover all the exits in and out, and exits and entrances to the general conference. And certainly when we first started doing this, we had many more conversations than we have over the past number of years. It has, you know, there would be some years you'd have a lot of conversations, some years you wouldn't have as many, but certainly, say up through about 1995 or so, you'd have more than I have noticed that we've had over the past 8 years or so. Then with the opening of the Meganackle, things really changed because people have to get in these long lines, and the traffic patterns are different, and people are trying to, you know, to get to where they need to go, and it's just made it very difficult, especially in the morning, to have meaningful conversations with folks. But we've done the best that we could, and you know, developed good lines to get people to stop and talk. And I certainly noticed that as soon as some Mormons, well, they're not really Mormons, they're fundamentalist Mormons, began showing up with these signs protesting the LDS Church's stand on abortion, that a lot of the conversations began to move away from wherever they were, first of all. Wherever anyone is standing like that with a sign, that Mormons automatically just lump everybody together. Once you walk outside of one of the gates, anybody who's out there, it doesn't matter how you're dressed, how you're acting, what you're doing, they're just going to lump you all into one group. And when it was just our group, that was fine, because they would come out and we would be there and we would be dressed nicely, frequently dressed similar to one another. We're all distributing the same literature, and we'd have lots of good conversations, things like that. But then, as I said, when these people began showing up with signs, I noticed that we really needed to move away from them. You don't get into as many conversations as we did before. Then, as most of you know, starting a couple of conferences ago, a year ago, we had Pastor Phelps, as he is called, show up, and his protest against homosexuals. And at the same time as Phelps showing up, we began to see the first street preachers. These are individuals with big old signs, sort of walking four spiritual laws, except not quite as complex as the four spiritual laws. And we noticed them, but they were sort of overshadowed that first trip by Phelps and his people, who were just absolutely outrageous in their hateful behavior and in their unchristian behavior and things like that. Then 6 months ago, Phelps and his people were not there, but it was the King James-only street preachers who were all over the place. And we reported on that. We had a main-page article with pictures. The article is still there in the LDS section, where we talked about street abusers and we talked about them yelling and screaming at people. Well, they, of course, were back again. They were there in Salt Lake City. And we are going to have on the website pictures and probably even some AVI files, so you can sort of see some brief sections of the video that we took of these individuals. They were back in force, and since we had dared to criticize them, now they had two targets. They not only had the Mormons, but they also had me, specifically. And so they were back in force, and they started the way they normally start, with their street abuse. And I'm going to play some sections for you, and I recognize some of these are going to be difficult for you to hear. For example, the first two that I'm going to play are off of my my camera, and this is just a little teeny tiny Canon power shot. I mean, it's a very small camera, and it takes AVI files, and I've stripped the sound out of an AVI file to play this for you. But if you listen carefully, you can certainly hear it. At least maybe on the archive you can, if maybe not live streaming. But anyways, this first one just gives you a little bit of a taste. This isn't outrageous preaching. It's just, if you know anything about Mormonism, you'll know that anyone hearing this is just going to go, okay, yeah, all right, you know a lot about what we believe. Now, we have not doctored this. When I first queued this one up, I almost didn't play it, because up in Salt Lake City, the crossing signals have a sound for people who are blind. And all the way through this little clip, you can hear one of these walking signals. And we did not put it in there, but it does sound rather ironic when you put the whole thing all together. Here, let me show you what I'm talking about.
Devil, that said, you can become as God. It was the devil that said you can become as God. Mormons believe in the devil's doctrine.
The Mormons believe in the devil's doctrine. That's one of the street preachers. He's holding a sign. If I recall correctly from the AVI, that was down at the northwest. It was across the street from the northwest corner of Temple Square. So it would be the southwest corner of the Meganacle. And so he's just preaching that the devil said you become a god. And yeah, there's an element of truth to that. But as you can tell, it's not exactly preached with a lot of knowledge of what's going on there. Now, I took my little camera up to the main section. This is directly across from the North Gate. It would be the south entrance to the what we call the Meganacle, the meeting house there. And the King James only guys were already there. And one of them, who is one of the ringleaders, we have a number of. It does sound like a cuckoo clock, doesn't it? I told you we did not stick it in there. Anyways, one of the ringleaders, he's an individual that I tried to talk to 6 months ago. And he was the one that I mentioned 6 months ago was just berating the Mormons. And this Mormon girl came up to him and he just ripped into her. And when we came back from lunch, I was actually going to role play a Mormon just simply to shred this guy. Because it's obvious he doesn't know anything about the Bible. He doesn't know anything about Mormonism. And when we walked up, there was a Mormon that I've talked to many, many times, a very well-read Mormon, who was already doing that. Now, I watched as a Mormon embarrassed this man. Just shredded this man, left him standing there without anything to say other than just go back to a couple of verses this guy had already gotten around. You would think that that experience would cause you maybe to have some humility. Nah, not this guy. No. I think his name's Reuben. At least that's what I've been told. His name's Reuben. And he's a big guy, but he's a mean, nasty guy. That's just all there is to it. And he was up at the North Gate, and I didn't get my camera out in time to catch the first thing that I heard. But the first thing I heard was, we'll call him Reuben, yelling at the Mormons who are streaming into the conference center, "You shouldn't be called Mormons! You should be called morons!" Yeah, that's what he was screaming. Isn't that deep? I mean, isn't that a wonderful way to share the gospel? You shouldn't be called Mormons, you should be called morons. Isn't that deep? And so I managed to get my camera out right after he had made this statement. And I started it right as he said, "And you know why they called him Brigham Young?" And right then I managed to get the AVI file started, and here's what the rest of that clip sounds like.
"Brigham Young, he likes them very.
There's Reuben. Now let me play that first section once again.
"Brigham Young, he likes them very young, 12 and 13 years old."
So what he says, you know why they call him Brigham Young? Because he wanted to bring them young, 12 and 13 years old. And this is what is being yelled at these well-dressed individuals who are carrying their quads and their scriptures, and they're going in to their meeting house. And here's a guy in shorts and a black t-shirt carrying a sign that has very little to do with Mormonism at all. And he's screaming at these Mormons, "You know why they called him Brigham Young? Because they want him to bring them young." Oh, that, now what kind of response is that going to get?
I think if you recall, he wanted he called that
voices.
Preaching.
He calls that preaching. Yes,
he wanted us to preach.
Yeah. Later on, we'll hear them saying, come out of the closet, King James White, and start doing some street preaching." Same guy. This whole type of attitude is what is pervasive in what these guys are doing. And what kind of response do you expect to get from the Mormons? You expect the Mormons to get out of the line and come over to him and go, "You know, you're right. I had never thought it. Could I find out what you believe?" Of course not, and that's not what they want. They just want people to hate them. They think that when people then react in anger or roll their eyes, oh, see, I'm being persecuted for righteousness' sake. I'm good. That's how these people think. They're a scourge, a plague on anyone who's trying to do anything up there in Salt Lake City. They truly are. And they're proud of this kind of attitude. They really are proud of that kind of attitude. We watched it all day long. Now, let me say something. There is everything right within a proper context of noting the unbiblical, unchristian activities of early Mormon church leaders in regards to polygamy. There is no question that polygamy was a step back from what Jesus himself had taught. One man, one woman, together for life. Adam and Eve. Not Adam and Eve and Isabel and Janet and everybody else. There's no question that there's plenty of things to say about Brigham Young and Joseph Smith, and I think you can make a very good case that Joseph Smith was sexually debauched. No question about that. But what context are you going to be able to present that in that's going to have any meaning for anyone? It's not going to have any meaning when you're standing there dressed like you just got off of work on a dock with a sign that means nothing, screaming at people as they walk across into a place where they consider themselves to be going to worship. It's absolutely, positively unbelievable to try to deal with these folks. It truly, truly is. All right, what we did is we had some of our new video cameras up in Salt Lake City to videotape the debate that was going to take place that evening. It was going to be a long day. I mean, because of financial constraints primarily, the sponsoring church up there, Christ Presbyterian Church, had obtained a place at the University of Utah. Beautiful place. One of the best venues we've ever done a debate in, I would say. Very nicely set up. Really, really nice place to do it. But the only way we could afford it is if we did it on Saturday night, because they didn't figure anybody would want to do anything on the Saturday night of conference. And so we scheduled the debate for Saturday night, and a bunch of people complained and yada, yada, yada. And we'll, of course, take that into consideration in the future. But anyways, we were going to be doing the debate that evening. So we had our video cameras up there with us. Very nice video cameras, excellent video cameras, and they're digital now. And so we had one of the video cameras out, and we had it set up over in the section. We had contacted the city. We wanted to be able to have some place where we could actually try to have conversations with someone without these people standing there and yelling in our ears. It didn't work out that way, but we tried. So we had contacted the city. We had taken out a protest permit. We had done the things you're supposed to do. We rendered unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. And, oh, did the King James only people not like that. So we had a camera set up. And so what we've done is we've taken the audio portion of that, and we've put it into a file. And I went through it today and pulled out a number of little clips, just to give you an idea. Now, some of these clips, it sounds like a bunch of noise, and that's the whole point. Imagine yourself. Put yourself in the position of the Mormon. You used to come out of the tabernacle in Temple Square, and there were some nicely dressed individuals who offered you literature. They weren't yelling at you. They weren't screaming at you. If you actually stopped to listen to them talking to someone else long enough, you discover that they'd studied your religion, they're carrying your scriptures, they know what you believe, and they show you respect. That's not the way it is anymore. Now you feel, both going in and going out, that you're running the gauntlet. You no longer feel, outside of when you're actually in the building, or when you get away from Temple Square and you get into where the food places are, you no longer feel comfortable. You don't like it there. It is a poisoned atmosphere. Here, let me give you an example of what I'm talking about.
Is that why four people got saved at the last Mormon conference?
Oh, wait a minute. This isn't the preaching part. Here is, there were two main people who later on we're going to hear them yelling and screaming at me. And they held signs up about me, about King James White, with quotes from letters to a Mormon elder. Yeah, they actually made up signs about me for this trip. And they call me King James White, King Jimmy. And they're mocking me and doing all the rest of this stuff. And this is one of the two. This is a fella who, right after I recorded what we just listened to, where the guy was talking about Mormons, it's morons and Brigham Young and stuff like that, right after that, I'm holding my little teeny camera up again, taking another AVI. And we have this AVI. And all of a sudden, something hits my hand and the camera. And, of course, I flinch, you know, because it came from behind my head. And it was one of these people with one of their signs. Well, believe it or not, at the time, I thought, naive me, I thought, someone wasn't watching where they were going. Then I saw the AVI later, and I realized, wrong. This was very purposeful. This individual, a quote-unquote street preacher, tried to use the edge of his sign to knock the camera out of my hand. And when you watch the AVI file, you can see him looking back to see if he was successful. Well, he wasn't, thankfully. This same guy, this section is him yelling at our people. And interestingly enough, during this particular point in time, I'm not there. I went down to the South Gate and had taken the time to sort of get away from things. We had some folks distributing literature at the South Gate, and I went down there to scan through a new Farms publication that we had purchased that day because it was relevant to the debate that night. And there's no way you'd ever have time to scan through something like that in with all the noise and everything that's going on at the North Gate. So I'm not even there, though you'll notice I get mentioned anyway. So here's the guy who tried to use the edge of his sign to knock the camera out of my hand. He's one of the two people who stand there mocking me for 45 minutes holding signs about me. But this is between his trying to knock the camera out of my hand and then the encounter later on when I am there when they pull out the signs about me. So this is one of those quote unquote street preachers.
Is that why four people got saved the last Mormon conference? Is that why you guys went and told half truths? We ain't making lemonade out of nothing, boys. Are in direct violation of God. Dr. James White is about to get a malpractice suit from God himself for teaching another gospel himself. You can't win Mormons teaching from an NIV, from a perverted text, and he don't even preach.
Actually,
the Bible says the foolishness comes from them that preach.
Don't talk to him. I'm going to use
James White is a phony, and you guys tell half-truths. Everybody that even saw that thing, all they could see is James White saying, I.
Now, can you sort of tell that this fellow doesn't like me? He accuses us of half-truths. They've never been able to document any of those. And, of course, we have more and more video now of exactly how they are behaving. I'm going to get a malpractice suit from God. I'm not preaching the gospel. And why? Because I use an NIV. Well, actually, I don't. The amazing thing about these men is their absolute incredible ignorance. I mean, they're some of the most ignorant men I've ever... Their signs have misspelled words on them. There's this guy at the north side. And just to give you background, he was just railing on me. He's holding this, it was sort of a yellowish sign, and it had all these false religions on it. And I even had a guy come up to me over at where we were standing and ask me, he said, man, you know, when you walked by, this guy was going, make way for Lucifer. Here comes Lucifer. What's his problem? And I got a chance to tell this guy all about these people, and he just couldn't believe him. He could not believe these people actually exist, but that was what they were saying. Make way for Lucifer. That's what they're saying about me. Well, here's this guy standing there with this sign, and I look at it, and all of a sudden I realize one of the groups that he's saying is wrong are Buddhists. Yes, Buddists. Buddhists. And we had a good time with that. Is that a springtime group when trees are budding? Just what is it? We know, of course, he meant Buddhists, Buddhists, but he couldn't spell it right. And later we amazing thing is, later we walked by him, and I just couldn't help it. I was sick and tired of these people. I said, by the way, it's he misspelled Buddhists, and his response is, yeah, I did it on purpose. I thought, yeah, should I stop and ask him exactly what your purpose was there? But I realized I probably couldn't handle the inane response that I would get back from that. So I just, you just walk by and you go, ah, whatever. Anyways, the ignorance of these folks, I work on the New American Standard. He doesn't know that. Where are we using the NIV? You just sit there and shake your head. So we've got a false gospel, because we've got the NIV and absolutely, positively unbelievable. This is once we get the pictures up, you'll be able to see this guy. He was wearing a wine-colored shirt, and we'll point him out. We'll probably attach this clip to it so you can listen to him railing away and so on and so forth. But this is the kind of stuff that we were putting up with. Let's listen to. Actually, we've got a couple of minutes for the next break. So let's listen to another clip here. It goes on from there, but it's difficult to hear. Let me move it down a little bit for the rest. You can sort of hear it in the background there. Actually, hear a number of them, and it was this cacophony of. Wine, W-I-N-E, wine-colored shirt. Come on, give me a break here. This cacophony of yelling, and you listen to some of it. Isaiah was a prophet, but Isaiah couldn't save you. Moses was a prophet, but Moses couldn't save you. And again, you have to try to put yourself in the shoes of the Mormons who are walking by, looking at these people going, where did they land from? I mean, how can you ever expect any Mormon person to give you the time of day when you obviously haven't given them the time of day? You don't know anything about what they believe or showing them any respect at all. Absolutely, positively amazing. It truly, truly is. Let's listen to another section.
Take his literature.
Okay, all right. All right, I gotta set this up. I didn't write down what all these cuts were. The lunch rush hits, and it's just thousands of Mormons. I mean, thousands of hungry Mormons heading for Crossroads Plaza and the ZCMI Center in downtown Salt Lake. I mean, I would imagine the restaurants do 30% of their entire year's money on those two conference weekends. I bet you they do. It's just a zoo as they head to go get their food. And so here comes 30,000 Mormons coming across the street. And I had a feeling. We knew they had some signs because we had seen them wrapped up and we had seen Letters to a Mormon Elder. We had seen my name. We knew it was coming. So as soon as the big rush hits, all of a sudden, the Reuben guy in black and then the guy that we just listened to railing at us about the malpractice, they whip out these two signs about me. Now, the signs weren't that bad. In fact, I found it absolutely, very strange because the quotations they used from Letters to a Mormon Elder were accurate. There was a quotation from Letters to a Mormon Elder where I said the Holy Spirit has never given anyone a testimony that Joseph Smith was a prophet. And I contrasted Christianity and Mormonism as the difference between monotheism versus polytheism. And all those things are true. The only thing I can figure out is they somehow think that I'm ashamed of what I've said in my books. And I'm not. They don't seem to understand that the issue is not that Mormonism is right. It's very clearly wrong. It's how you communicate that to Mormons that's the issue. They don't know how to do it. I mean, they're right that Mormonism's wrong. They just don't know why, and they don't seem to care to learn from anyone how to do it. That's the issue. So they had these signs, but then they started mocking. As you can listen to, they're mocking me. They're just, I'm not going to play this clip, but there is one point where they're saying, that man's so intelligent, his brain's so big, his hair fell out. I mean, at that point, I said to Rich, these guys could go on the road. I mean, they're hilarious. That's the clip we're going to play, and this is called a teaser, see? We're going to take our break, and if you go away, if you touch that dial, well, there's not a dial on a computer, but if you disconnect, you're not going to be able to hear that particular section, which we're going to play right after this break. Be right back.
It's all works righteousness, you know. Can I manufacture grace for self-denial in some religious place by weeping hard on your face or saying prayers to some dead saints, you know? It's not through creeds or liturgy.
The history of the Christian Church pivots on the doctrine of justification by faith. Once the core of the Reformation, the Church today often ignores or misunderstands this foundational doctrine. In his book, The God Who Justifies, theologian James White calls believers to a fresh appreciation of, understanding of, and dedication to the great doctrine of justification, and then provides an exegesis of the key scripture texts on this theme. Justification is the heart of the gospel. In today's culture, where tolerance is the new absolute, James White proclaims with passion the truth and centrality of the doctrine of justification by faith. Dr. J. Adams says, "I lost sleep over this book. I simply couldn't put it down." James White writes the way an exegetically and theologically oriented pastor appreciates. This is no book for casual reading. There is solid meat throughout, an outstanding contribution in every sense of the words. The God Who Justifies by Dr. James White. Get your copy today at aomen.org.
How the Pilgrim's Progress is not an easy way. It's a journey to the sun, day by day. Following Jesus.
And welcome back to Dividing Line. We are reporting on our interesting experiences in Salt Lake City. And as I said before the break, the fellow who wore the wine-colored... That's not wine. What is that? It's not really... Is that the ASU color type thing? What was... colors. I'm not really good at colors. Anyways, the same guy we listened to before about the malpractice suit, he and Ruben, the dude in the shorts with the black shirt, and they've whipped out the King James White signs, and here's what we listened to for 45 minutes.
Take his literature. He talks all about you Mormons. You need to take the bald guy's literature. He'll tell you, but you gotta buy his book. He won't preach to you, but you gotta buy his book. Maybe you need to read James White literature. This is what he says to you. King James knows what he's talking about when he slams you Mormons. All you have to do is buy his book. But go ahead and spend your money on his book. He won't give it to you free. He's got the truth. And the Bible does say, free, you give it away free. That's what Jesus Christ says. But if you want to know the truth about your cult and church, you need to read all about James White.
The doctrine's a little off, though. He goes out of the NIV.
Kind of odd. Kind of like the Mormons.
The doctrine teaches, go and tell the women, take the gospel, but don't say go and preach. So he's got a little off there.
I love you, don't touch on
the key of what the Mormons.
Yeah, well.
They were a bunch of perverts. Listen, if Brigham Young was alive today, he'd be on a Jerry Springer show. If Joseph Smith were alive today, he'd be on a Jerry Springer show. He wouldn't be a founder of a church.
This bald guy right here.
Listen to this. That's trust. He's got it together. He'll put you Mormons in your place.
I love Dale Kiplinger.
Through Adam, Sam Rose. The Bible says, God, I don't want to be like you.
Well, that's right.
That's my honor.
Understand?
Well, there's I'm watching the reaction of people in the channel, and that's pretty much the reaction of all the Mormons. Can you imagine what the Mormons are thinking while this is going on? They're looking at these people. Now, what I didn't mention to you is let me see if I can find this one kid. There's this one kid in a blue jacket, and you know, I just felt sorry for him. I mean, this kid is just, I mean, he is not the sharpest knife in the drawer. You know what I mean? The term dim bulb comes to mind here. We're just not running on all eight cylinders. And he's been sucked in by these guys, and he thinks this is just wonderful. And he's the one you can hear going, "My favorite person's Gail Kiplinger." Let me see if I can.
That's right. He's got it together. He'll put you Mormons in your place.
I love Gail Kiplinger.
There it is. There it is. I love Gail Kiplinger. Here it is.
I love Gail Kiplinger. I love Gail Kiplinger.
It's Riplinger. Oh, you're all going, "Nah, come on." But you got to realize this kid put on a skull cap to make him bald to look like me. And so he's standing next to these other dudes. They're yelling this stuff. And this kid's got this bald cap on. And he doesn't even know what Gail Riplinger's name is.
I love Gail Kiplinger.
Thank you. Oh, man. Can you imagine what the Mormons are thinking here? I mean, they're just going, "You've got to be kidding me. This is
Joseph and Brigham on the Jerry
Springer show. Yeah, these guys look like refugees from the Jerry Springer show. I mean, either one of them could be the bouncers on the Jerry Springer show, couldn't they? Especially the Reuben dude, the guy in the black, if that's his name. He looks just like those bouncers on the Jerry Springer show. Absolutely positively amazing. Let's listen to some more of this wonderfully deep stuff.
Really rebuke you people and put you in your place. Please come to the debates.
Now, did you hear that? He says, "Please come to the debates." They knew about the debates. And in this section, they make some comments about the debates.
Please come to the debates.
And there's the
I don't know if you heard that, but he's going, "Come out of the closet, King James, become a preacher."
Come out of the closet.
That means
you need to read his letter.
And if men do not want that life,
get his literature.
They do not want to learn from a wicked world.
Go get his literature. He was upset. He only passed out a few
things. They do not want to learn from sin.
Now, I don't know if you heard that last section. Take his literature. He was upset because they only passed out a few pieces of literature. And we're talking about the fact that we mentioned in the web article that when these people are around, Mormons will not take tracts. They don't want to. They just automatically assume everybody is all in the same group. And one of the worst things that I thought, other than just the complete idiocy that these people were portraying to the Mormons, was, as we're going to hear a little bit later on, they were dishonest. They started saying, "We're with them." Now, one little section here. This is this is a little clip. This is only 7 seconds long. There were some Mormon girls. And, of course, we mentioned 6 months ago what these people did to some of these little Mormon girls. And it was disgusting. But there's some Mormon girls watching these guys. And, you know, these guys, the cap on that makes them look bald, and they're sitting there yelling and what they're... Can you imagine, what does a Mormon think King James White is? I mean, a white Bible? Is that what are these people talking about? I mean, they really, this is the Jerry Springer show as far as they're concerned. But there's these girls that came up. And we also noticed in the video some missionaries would, like, stand in front of them and get pictures taken just like, you know, hey, look, you know, it's sort of like when you have pictures taken in front of the ape display at the zoo, you know, and
the
hey, look.
Circus is in town.
Yeah, circus is in town. Yeah, they've showed up outside the thing here. Well, some of these girls were doing the same thing. And I want you to listen to the comment that we found on the video. Did you catch that? Let me play this middle section again. They look like idiots. Well, you know, out of the mouths of babes. Yeah, that's exactly what they look like. There's no two ways about it. I mean, you look at the videos of this stuff, it's absolutely incredible. Well, we continue on. Now, did you catch that? I had not caught that till just now. He wants to take Joseph Smith's place. This bald guy right there, King James White, wants to take Joseph Smith's place.
He wants to take Joseph Smith's place. King James White, this bald guy right here at the gate, wants you to follow him. He wants you to follow his doctrine, and he wants you to get right with God. King James White. This guy is going to debate you guys tonight. He's going to rip your butts, he said. He's going to debate you guys tonight and show you guys how that he's going to win, you guys. He's never lost in a debate.
That's right.
King James White said he never lost in a debate.
He'll put you in your place.
Come on. Come on. Come and see the King James White.
Now, I noticed something. That man, this is the guy in the maroon shirt is the actual color. Thank you very much. He's losing his voice. Now, you know, Gail Ripplinger would undoubtedly come up with something interesting about that. So would Tex Mars. But anyways, I guess when King James only people lose their voice, that's not relevant. But anyways, he's lying. I never said any of those things that he's attributing to me. And he knows it. He has absolutely, positively, no problem whatsoever lying through his teeth. These quote-unquote street preachers have no problem lying as long as it promotes their cause.
Debate of the century. He's going to debate one of your best Mormon scholars. And he said he's going to rip him. You got to go see him.
Please take his debate, his literature, so he can stop whining and complaining. Would you please take these people debate literature? They will put your Mormons in your place. Maybe he'll give you a Mormon discount since the church has already fleeced you. Maybe he'll have compassion and give you a 2-for-1 discount.
Or he might even give you 5% off. But you gotta buy his book. You broke your stuff back. You got to buy yourself and stop for the church.
Please take his literature.
I agree with most of them. And I tell you what, use the money so we can put more pamphlets out. But you guys can take a ride. Help him out, guys. King James White.
Help him out, guys. King James White. That was the last little section there. Don't worry. There's only one left because you're probably going, stop. I certainly, after watching it the second time, it wasn't enjoyable the first time, but it was pretty incredible. This last clip is a section where these men are simply lying. They lied before, but here you can see exactly what they want to do. And you, again, one of the reasons we're doing this, let me just mention, there are probably some good people who might not like my Calvinism or something like that, but recognize that we're doing a good work anyways, who may be sending money to the sponsoring churches of these organizations. Some of these people work with streetpreachers.org, there is a church in Salt Lake City, that was putting all these people up. What was the name of that? Do you remember the name of that place?
I think it was Bible Baptist.
I know it was a King James only Baptist church up there. I'm not sure if it was Bible. I think Bible Baptist sounds right. Anyways, we are encouraging folks, find out if your church supports these people. If you consider this preaching, if you consider this Christian activity, then keep supporting them. But if you recognize what any rational person can recognize in listening just to what, and we haven't even, we don't even have the videos here. I'm just showing you just little clips. Then you realize these people are not deserving of a dime of God's people's monies. They are individuals who have absolutely positively, no sense of biblical calling. They don't understand biblical truth. They are mockers. I now understand the meaning of the mockery of fools from the book of Proverbs. This is very, very much, about it. And, so one of the reasons we're showing you, they're playing these things is so you can hear it from their own mouths. Because we have the video of them saying these things. Now notice what they're doing here. Listen to what they're going to say.
What are they can come up here and then they come back and leave.
Let it be a curse.
Here's my house, Jim.
Can I be? Let it be a curse.
Please take this medicine so we can put you out of your place.
You guys got to take this.
We are all together. We're working here together.
Catch that? Catch that? We are all together. We're working here together.
We are all together. We're working here together. We're working with these guys here. We're with these guys.
Hold on there.
You heard me saying, oh, no, they're not. Now we're bearing false witness. Listen to what they said again.
We're working here together. We're working with these guys here. We're with these guys.
We're working with these guys. We're with these guys.
We're with these guys here. We're with these guys.
Now, that's a lie. He knows it's a lie. He knows we would never for a second associate ourselves with these individuals. And it's very clear that they have no concern about truth. That's just all there is to it. And so they need to be, they need to hear from the people of God. I think that it would be perfectly proper, since some of these people are associated with streetpreachers.org, to contact streetpreachers.org and say, what I heard on the dividing line is absolutely reprehensible. And I'm going to make sure that my church never considers supporting anything like this, and I think you should repent of your activities. And the sponsoring church up there that put these people up, same thing. Now, there is one individual, and when one of the street preacher people contacted me, I sent him back an email filled with pictures documenting these things, and I did include a picture of one individual, and I don't know who he is. He was wearing a green jacket. He was an older individual. Sort of gray or blonde hair, and I even took the time to get a picture of him from our video that we have of what was going on, and I sent it to the head of this organization. I said, now, to be fair, there is one individual that, to my knowledge, and I wasn't there the whole time, but to my knowledge, I never heard this individual address us directly. I never heard him say anything about us to anyone else. He never engaged in the mockery. And in his preaching, I never heard him say things like Mormons should be called morons or Brigham Young or any of that kind of stuff. Everything I heard from him, at least, and you've heard what we're listening to here. I mean, it's not like you can, you can't even listen to a lot of this. I mean, it's a cacophony of competing sounds. If you're walking through one of these areas, you're just going to hear bits and pieces and snippets, and one person's going to be talking over another person, and all you hear is this massive amount of noise, and you just want to get out of there. You just want to get away as much as you can. Anyways, in all that I heard of this man's preaching, I never heard him use that kind of language. He always, to what I heard, stuck to a simple gospel message. He said things about works and trusting in Christ. It's not that he really had a message that would resonate with Mormons. Most Mormons would listen to what he was saying and go, yeah, so. But despite all that, I want to be fair and say there was one individual, who, as far as I could tell, was fairly, controlled along those lines. He seemed fairly fairly stable. The others were not. Now, to my knowledge, he did not reprimand any of those individuals, and he should have. So he's not blameless. But I just didn't hear him do those things. So that's what we had to put up with. And you may say, well, how do you stand there and listen to that kind of harangue? It wasn't fun. I'm sort of glad that some of the guys weren't there during the worst part of it. My son was there, and he just couldn't believe it. He wanted to go over and introduce himself to them forcefully, but he didn't. And it wasn't enjoyable. Like I said, I now know what the prating of fools is all about. There's no two ways about it. Any one of these individuals alone would not be able to even begin to hold his own in any type of debate, argument, study of scripture, anything. But when they get together in a group, oh my, we are truly brave, aren't we? It was difficult. But one of the things that I kept in the back of my mind was, well, tonight there's going to be, and we estimate about 400. We had about 400 people. And they were at a debate on deification where I was debating Martin Tanner on that particular subject. And I had an opportunity there to present the truth about God and contrast that with the teachings of the Mormon Church. Now, I was going to have 400 people listen to what I said for about 2 hours. And they were going to walk away from there with something meaningful. And I knew that these men will never have that opportunity. They will never stand before a group of people and have the opportunity that I had, because there's not a Mormon in the world that would... for a second put up with that kind of behavior. And they know that. In fact, interestingly enough, four of their main leaders, including both of the men who were doing the mocking we were just listening to, came to the debate. In fact, right as we were putting the camera up, unfortunately we don't have this on tape, but right as we were putting the camera up, they were talking about the debates, and the Reuben fellow looked right at me and said, oh, we know where the debate's going to be, and we're going to be there, and you ain't seen nothing yet. Now, they're standing there mocking me, holding signs, and he says, you ain't seen nothing yet. Well, they came, they sat, they were silent, and they left. They didn't do anything, which I'm thankful for. But they obviously want us to think that they were going to, because isn't that how terrorists work? Terrorists work along those lines. They want you to be afraid. And, of course, we had to take steps just to make sure that if they did get up, that there were going to be police there who were going to escort them out. And, you know, that was... They want to do everything they possibly can to end our outreach to the Mormon people. They are the greatest allies the Mormons have ever had. Think about that one for a moment. It's a pretty amazing thing to think of. So that's what allowed me to stand there and to listen to all this and to go, yeah, okay, all right, well, what can I say? You know, you can't reason with these people. They won't listen to what you say. When you provide refutation of something that they say, they don't listen to it. They don't respond rationally. There's no reasoning with these people. They don't have reasoning capacities. So why even respond to them? It gets you absolutely nowhere. This is one of those situations. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest he think himself wise. This is where you have to realize, hey, this man is not listening. This man cannot hear what I have to say. And therefore, why worry about it? You just know that, and you deal with it from there. So that's what we put up with. When we come, I'm not sure when we can take our break here because we're a little bit ahead. But on the flip side of the break, what I'm going to do is I'm going to play for you the cross-examination section from the debate that evening. And you can download this from our MP3 page, which Mr. Pierce has been working so very, very hard on. And he's got it really spiffed up nicely. And we had the MP3s up, I think, wasn't it Monday? Something like that. I mean, Monday or Tuesday. I think it was Tuesday. We had the MP3s and the audio files up. And this is available on video. You can order the video of this, the whole nine yards. And so this is just a little section of it. You're going to want to get the whole thing. I'm not going to play the whole thing. It's called a teaser. But this is the cross-examination period where we are discussing the issue of deification. And again, here I'm debating a man with a doctorate in jurisprudence. He is an attorney, and we are discussing deification. And it always is interesting to me that there are those individuals, there, you know, the Roman Catholics or the Mormons or others, that'll say, he ain't no real scholar, you know. Oh, well, yeah, he's taught for a long time, and yeah, he's written 18 books, but he's no real scholar. Well, you know, I'm one of those folks that sort of figures scholarship proves itself, you know. Remember Forrest Gump? Stupid is as stupid does. Well, I think scholarship is as scholarship does. And so, if people judge scholarship on the basis of where you went to school, just what's on your diploma, okay, fine, great. But I'm one of those folks that sort of figures if you can't teach your way out of a paper bag, you're probably not much of a scholar. You know, if you can't communicate, you can't string words together in a meaningful fashion, you're probably not much of a scholar. So I think that scholarship is judged by what you do with it, not by the name on a piece of paper. And so when we come back, we're going to listen to the cross-examination section and let you judge for yourself how that particular encounter went. Here on The Dividing Line, we'll be right back.
A godly man is such a rarity today. So many stars, strong and true, quickly fall away.
What is Dr. Norman Geisler warning the Christian community about in his book Chosen But Free, A New Cult, Secularism, False Prophecy Scenarios? No, Dr. Geisler is sounding the alarm about a system of beliefs commonly called Calvinism. He insists that this belief system is theologically inconsistent, philosophically insufficient, and morally repugnant. In his book The Potter's Freedom, James White replies to Dr. Geisler, but the Potter's Freedom is much more than just a reply. It is a defense of the very principles upon which the Protestant Reformation was founded. Indeed, it is a defense of the very gospel itself. In a style that both scholars and laymen alike can appreciate, James White masterfully counters the evidence against so-called extreme Calvinism, defines what the Reformed faith actually is, and concludes that the gospel preached by the Reformers is the very one taught in the pages of Scripture. The Potter's Freedom, a defense of the Reformation and a rebuttal to Norman Geisler's Chosen But Free. You'll find it in the Reformed Theology section of our bookstore at aomen.org. Incorporating the most recent research and solid biblical truth, Letters to a Mormon Elder by James White is a series of personal letters written to a fictional Mormon missionary. Examining the teaching and theology of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the book brings a relational approach to material usually presented in textbook style. James White draws from his extensive apologetics ministry to thousands of Mormons in presenting the truth of Christianity. With well-defined arguments, James White provides readers with insight and understanding into the Book of Mormon, the prophecies, visions, and teachings of Joseph Smith, the theological implications of the doctrines of Mormonism, and other major historical issues relevant to the claims of the LDS Church. This marvelous study is a valuable text for Christians who talk with Mormons and is an ideal book to be read by Mormons. Letters to a Mormon Elder. Get your copy today in the Mormonism section of our bookstore at aomen.org.
Alrighty, this section takes a little bit over 30 minutes. I'm not sure we're going to get all the way through it, but let's go ahead and get started with the cross-examination. This is the debate that evening at the University of Utah.
Now we have questions from Dr. Tanner for Dr. White.
First question I would have here is, since most of the new encyclopedias, reference works on early Christianity now include articles on deification, do you still believe that there is no such thing as a doctrine of deification in early Christianity?
I have never said there was not a doctrine of deification in early Christianity. In fact, I was taught the doctrine of theosis as a seminary student at Fuller Theological Seminary. It was presented. It's presented in all the standard works. It's found in Laterette, Schaff, and the others. My issue, of course, this evening is not that there was not a doctrine of theosis, but what it meant, to those who taught it.
Okay, fair enough. Do you have an explanation for why it is, at least recently, only the evangelical works on Christianity that omit references to deification?
Well, you'd have to give us some specifics on evangelical references. I can't explain what you see as a trend. I included an entire chapter on the subject in my book, Is the Mormon My Brother? As I mentioned to you, Kenneth Scott Lauderette and others do have sections on it, so I don't know what you're referring to when you say that there is no reference to it.
Well, maybe I can ask it the other way. Can you think of an evangelical Christian that has written articles and does believe in deification, in the sense that men can become gods?
Well, again, in the sense that the early church fathers meant it, yes, because anyone who believes that man is a spiritual being and that it is his goal to be united with Christ, I think anyone here who's familiar, for example, with the writings of Jonathan Edwards is aware of the fact that Edwards spoke very much of the union of the elect with God in heaven and the ever-increasing relationship that exists between them, so much so that some people criticize him for that particular belief. And so I think you would have to include Edwards as a rather major writer at that particular point. But again, I think it goes to what you understand this doctrine to mean and the context in which it was first enunciated.
Okay. You don't understand the Latter-day Saints or any other brand of Christianity to believe that humans on the earth who are Christians or not are somehow gods now, do you?
Are gods now?
Yeah. You don't believe that anyone has ever taught that, do you?
Not in the sense of God being God,
okay.
No.
Okay. Wonderful.
God's an embryo is the terminology that I quoted from the sources.
Correct, and that is what Latter-day Saints believe as well as early Christians, although rather than the word embryo, they use the word prototype, at least as the Erdmann's publication has translated it.
Is that a question?
No, the question is, there was no question there. If we read, as I believe we do in Ephesians, that we will grow into mature manhood until we reach the stature of Christ in all his completeness. If
is that
we have the word,
sir?
Yes, if we have the word completeness in there, what does that leave of an unbridgeable gulf?
The term is pleromatos to Christou, the fullness of Christ. And therefore, you would have to understand what Paul is referring to there. It seems that if you're asking me what I believe the fullness of Christ refers to, it does not mean my ceasing to be a man and becoming what Christ is in his nature. But instead, as Paul teaches, the Holy Spirit is active in our life, conforming us to the what? To the image of Christ, to the likeness of Christ. The whole purpose, that Paul says in Romans 8, is that we are being conformed to the likeness of Christ. We are being made Christ-like, and that's certainly what Christians believe.
So do you take the idea that someone would be Christ by nature to be a statement that they were a god now? Or I would like to know what you are trying to differentiate by your use of that term nature. Are you talking about created versus uncreated or something else?
Well, the Apostle Paul is very, very clear that Jesus Christ is extremely unique, and he differentiates between Jesus Christ and any other being and any other created person, and therefore I allow him to keep that distinction when he talks about the fullness of Christ. This fullness of Christ is within the context, the discussion here, of the work of the Holy Spirit in the body in conforming us to Christ's image. And so therefore, I would understand that as it continues on in verse 15, talking about in truth and so on and so forth, growing up into Christ as our head. We don't become the head of the church or anything like that.
Do you take Athanasius to be an Orthodox early Christian father?
Yep. In most things, yes.
Do you believe his quote where he says, God became man so that man may become God?
In the context in which he stated it, which for Athanasius, as I've attempted to point out, was of a belief in the God being uncreated, man being created, and therefore men becoming gods does not mean we become gods as God is a god. We are becoming gods in a sense as spiritual creatures. We are united with Christ and partake of the divine nature.
Okay. Well, in a sense, I think that any other kind of reference would be to a straw man. Do you take it that somehow Latter-day Saints or other branches of Christianity believe something different, that the faithful Christians will become gods some other way than the way that you've described?
Yes, in fact, as this publication I read from Farms points out, the author there demonstrates the difference in the means of exaltation in Mormonism and the means of divinization in the early church fathers. That's one of the differences that he cites, is that the very means by which this takes place is different, and of course he himself points out the vast chasm that exists between God and man on the level of ontology as well. So, yes, I believe, as I read from the article, that, for example, celestial marriage is required for divinization in LDS theology, and I am not aware of any group that would, for example, make that reference. Certainly Athanasius didn't.
That would be true. But do you believe that any early church fathers who are orthodox had a view that men cannot become gods?
There were a number who did not address it in that language at all. I'm not aware of Tertullian addressing it. Certainly Ignatius did not. It wasn't an issue for them, as I've been trying to point out. The context in which they're even using the language is not a Protestant Mormon context. It is the context of the paganism of their day that viewed man as a mere creature, not as a spiritual being. And therefore, their emphasis is that salvation's real. Something really happens to the person who is saved. There is a glorious future. It's not as the Greeks would say, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. There's something very special about mankind.
So as to this topic here, can men become gods, you would answer yes.
In the context in which you're talking about the early church, or the context of Mormonism? My whole point has been that the context of the early church is vastly different than the context of Mormonism, since Mormonism says that God himself became a man and that we are of the same species as God. The answer to that, of course, would be no, because God has eternally been God and we have not been eternally God and will not eternally be gods. In the context of the early church fathers, that we are spiritual creatures and as such are united with God in their language, then we can affirm that assertion.
Okay. Well, I am not asserting that Protestants are Mormons, or Mormons are Catholics, or Mormons are Protestants. There are some distinctions, but I'm glad that we can both agree that in a certain sense, men can become gods, which was the issue of our debate tonight. Can men become gods? Apparently, Reverend White thinks they can in certain contexts, and Latter-day Saints believe it as well.
Is that a question?
Would you agree?
No, I think we're mixing context here, obviously. I do not believe that I would engage in the debate.
So you don't believe, then, that men can become gods?
In the LDS context, no, men cannot become gods.
But in a Protestant context, yes?
And again, the only people who utilize that language were individuals who are working in an apologetic situation where they are dealing with individuals who did not believe that men were truly spiritual beings, and that therefore they did not believe that it would be even rational that God would enter into the physical creation so as to redeem something as worthless as man. In that context, emphasize the meaning of glorification, I can understand the terminology that they utilized, yes.
Okay, well, and I am not here to somehow say that you believe deification to be the same thing as any other person in this room, or as any Latter-day Saint, or as in any of the church fathers. You've said earlier that you disagree with some of their statements, but I would take it then that, in a certain sense, you would agree with Latter-day Saints that men can become gods, although you think the process and the result is different.
No, I think I've been very, very clear in stating so far that the LDS context is so completely foreign to anything that can be understood biblically or anything that can be understood in early church history as to put it into a context that the words now communicate something else. As I've said frequently, repetitively, for an early church father who believed that God has eternally been God, to say that men can become gods in the context in which they spoke was one thing. For Joseph Smith to say that men can become gods, that we need to learn how to dwell in everlasting burnings as God himself once did, is something completely different. I think most folks can see the vast difference between those two statements. So I would not say that in the LDS context I would agree at all.
But in a Protestant context you would? Well, I came here tonight to debate the concept of can men become gods. Apparently you came here to debate LDS doctrine. That's interesting. Okay. What did you come here tonight to debate?
I came here to debate the topic of on the thing there. It says a Protestant LDS debate, and here at the University of Utah, I think everyone, including those who are outside the temple today at the conference, knows that when a Mormon apologist and a Protestant apologist get together to debate that particular statement, that the issue is going to be defined by the fundamental differences that separate us. And those fundamental differences are on the nature of God and what it means when we even talk about gods. And so I think the meaning of the debate and the purpose of the debate is very, very clear. I don't think anyone was confused about it before we came here.
Do you believe that the Son has the full nature of God within him?
Eternally.
And do you believe that certain Christians will grow until they reach the stature of Christ in all his completeness?
Actually, the term is, again, as I mentioned a few moments ago, pleromatos, the fullness of Christ, which in the context of Ephesians 4:13 is not talking about the nature of Christ that is somehow communicated to believers, but the work of the Holy Spirit within them, where the fullness of God's work is accomplished within them to where they are conformed to his image.
Do you believe that in the Bible all references to gods, plural, are references to idols?
Primarily, you'd have to be specific. The vast majority of them are.
How about
Psalms
82?
Places in Psalm 82, Psalm 82:6, where the context makes us very clear that we're talking about human judges. For the very next verse says, "You shall die like men and fall like any one of the princes." And the preceding verses establish the context.
Well,
these were individuals. If I could answer the question, that these
were
individuals.
Well, I asked about Psalm 82, not Psalm 86.
I said 82:6, sir.
Well, I'm talking about Psalm 82, verse 1.
Yes.
God presides in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, adjudicates. Do you think that's a reference to idols?
No, it's as I was just mentioning, Psalm 82, specifically I looked at verse 6, but the entire psalm does mention this. Psalm 82 is about human judges, because it says verse 2, which always follows after verse 1, "How long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked, vindicate the weak and fatherless?" Always a command to human judges in the Old Testament context. "Do justice to the afflicted and destitute." Even in Mormon theology, I have been told many, many times that the other gods that allegedly exist do not have anything to do with this planet. And yet here you have commands to these gods to do justice here upon this planet. That obviously indicates that these are the judges of Israel, who, standing in the place of God, using God's law, are to judge as God would have them to judge.
Well, let's see if you think that the Good News Bible quotation, which says that God presides in the heavenly council in the assembly of gods, is a reference to earthly beings.
Well, I work on the New American Standard Bible, which says God takes his stand in his own congregation. He judges in the midst of the rulers. And again, I prefer translating the Bible within its own context, and that context indicates, in light of the command to vindicate the weak and the fatherless, etc., etc., and then the statement in verse 7, "Nevertheless, you will die like men and fall like any one of the princes," that this is a reference to human judges, and any other understanding of Psalm 82 is to rip it out of its context and not see it in its fullness.
And that about is my turn. Thank you.
We will now have cross-examination from Dr. White to Dr. Tanner.
Dr. Tanner, do you agree with the publication that I cited initially, Achieving a Celestial Marriage, from the LDS Church,
in regards to its teaching that God became God by obedience to law?
Yes, I do. I have no reason to disbelieve that.
Okay. So do you believe that God is God by nature, or did God obtain the status of godhood?
I believe that the answer to that question is not found in the Bible. It doesn't say that in the Bible that God is God by nature, or how he got there. It does say from everlasting to everlasting. There have been a number of different interpretations about what that means. I'll leave it there. Let you ask your next follow-up.
I didn't fully understand. So did he obtain the position in LDS, in light of LDS revelation? Did God obtain his position as God?
I think that there are Latter-day Saints who would take both positions on that. I don't know that there is any hard and fast LDS doctrine that one would have to believe. Myself, I think it's an open question, but I don't have any problem with the idea that has been expressed there.
Are you familiar with any early church father, especially amongst those you've cited, which would include Irenaeus, Athanasius, Augustine, who believed that God became God by obedience to law?
No, that is not a subject or a question that they addressed at all. They didn't discuss that.
Did any of those early church fathers say that God had eternally been God and that God was, in fact, completely different than man?
Yes, and I think Latter-day Saints would agree with that. You've taken the position here today that Latter-day Saints somehow don't believe that God is different by nature from the rest of us. He certainly is. He is God. Now we are mere mortals.
So you believe that nature and position are the same thing? Well, let me change the question. You have said that we are of the same genus, species as God. Do you agree with the statement that we are God's an embryo?
What I quoted was Paul, who said that, and he used the Greek phrase genos, which is the same one, genus, species, we are his offspring. Yes, I believe that to be true.
That we are God's an embryo.
Yes, that's okay. Also a quotation from the early church fathers. They believe that we were gods in prototype. They didn't use the word embryo like Latter-day Saints. They used the word prototype.
So if we are gods in embryo, as you just said, then is it not the case that we share the same nature as God, since he also is God?
Well, in a sense, we share the same nature as God, as we learn in the New Testament. If we didn't share, in a sense, his same nature, we would not be said to be his children in the New Testament. Are we in complete of the same nature as God now? Absolutely not. No one would take that position.
Wouldn't you agree that the Lord Jesus said that to become the children of God, we have to believe in Jesus Christ?
Yes.
Why would we have to become the children of God if we all are the children of God by nature?
Well, there's a difference between what we have been brought into the world as children of God through the fall of Adam and what we have the potential to be. If you have a child, you probably have children. I'm sure you do. We've talked about that many times. Your child has, to a certain degree, your nature as a child, but he also has tremendous potential. And as he or she grows up, he can attain more and more of your nature as he does so.
Would you agree with Joseph Smith that God never had the power to create the spirit of man at all?
I would believe, along with Joseph Smith, along with many Catholic and Orthodox scholars and many Jewish scholars who believe that the beginning of Genesis speaks of a creation not out of nothing, but out of existing elements and matter. And I would also agree with many of the early Christian church fathers that there was a preexistence of humans.
Could you explain what Zechariah 12:1 says, where Jehovah creates the spirits of men?
Well, I think you have to do what you asked us to do earlier, and that is to read the entire Bible in context. It does indeed talk about that in Zechariah. It does indeed, at the beginning of Genesis, talk about a creation out of pre-existing matter. Exactly how we are to meld those two together, I don't know. I do know that there are many Old Testament scriptures that do talk about a pre-existence of man, and that God knew about us from the beginning. As a matter of fact, one of the great doctrines of Calvin and of Luther that many here today believe is that from the beginning, God knew what would happen with all of us. He knew about all creation from the beginning to the end. Certainly in that sense, even in a Protestant context, we have all existed for all time. God didn't at one point come up with some new knowledge or new idea, even from a Protestant context, about humans. He knew of our existence forever and ever and ever. In that sense, even in a Protestant context, we have always existed and always will.
Are you saying there is no difference between the assertion that we pre-existed as spirit children in a heavenly realm and the Reformed understanding that God, by his decree, forms all things, works all things after the counsel of his will, and therefore knows, I'm not sure if you're referring to the term foreknow, or just what it is, but are you saying there's no difference between
I did not say there was no difference.
Okay, so what passages would you refer to that would indicate to you that the Bible teaches that men existed in a spiritual form prior to their existence upon this earth?
I would point to the beginning of Jeremiah, where it talks about Jeremiah being known to God before. I would also talk about the reference in the New Testament to the blind man, where Jesus is asked whether the blind man or his parents sinned that he was born blind. That has to be some kind of a reference to a pre-existence in which, in some kind of a personal form, they existed.
In Jeremiah 1:5, when it says, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you, and before you were born, I consecrated you, I have appointed you a prophet to the nations," why would you not believe that the parallel in the Hebrew of knew is, "I consecrated you, and I appointed you a prophet to the nations"? Why do you believe that that requires Jeremiah to have existed for God's sovereign decree to take place?
You don't have to believe that he existed, but that is a clear reference in the way that most Jews who have read this passage and who have written about it believed it. Many Jews believe in a pre-existence. Many Christians who have looked at that subject believe in a pre-existence as well. Some do not. If you would choose not to, that's your prerogative.
So in John chapter 9, could you not also understand that this is simply a reference to God's sovereign decree, that this man is, in light of Exodus chapter 4, where God makes the eye blind or the tongue dumb, that this man was born that way so that he might glorify God in his healing at the hands of Jesus Christ?
That is one possible reading without question. There are many, many ways that people can interpret the scriptures, which is why we have so many different Christian denominations.
You had said, my understanding was in your presentation, you said that the Reformers, John Calvin and Martin Luther, really began emphasizing this gulf existing between God and man. And yet, I read from Irenaeus in the just one sentence prior to that citation that you gave, where he specifically utilizes that very same language. How could Irenaeus speak of this massive difference between the uncreated God and the created man when Irenaeus lived a good 1,300 years prior to the birth of John Calvin?
I didn't say it didn't exist before Calvin and Luther. I said that they brought it to the fore. They're the ones who really are the ones that began to emphasize that doctrine. If that's not what I said, that's the way it is. There were statements about that earlier. That was certainly not a major emphasis, but in Protestant doctrine, it has definitely become a major one.
Would you agree with the Lutheran scholar Betts, who you cited earlier in Reflections on Mormonism, that Joseph Smith's view of God was naive?
No, I would not. I think that for his day and his background and his knowledge and the information that he had quite an amazing knowledge of God. However, it is true that he did not have the works and the writings that you have and that I have to study. So, in that context, you could say that he was naive in the sense that they weren't available. But based on what he had available, I would not care to use the word naive.
Is Yaroslav Pelikan in error when he specifically insists in discussing theosis that the early church fathers were avoiding saying that deification made a human being God by nature?
I think that's a broad oversimplification. I think there are many, many different views from many, many different Christian church fathers, some of whom you would find orthodox, some of whom I would, in some contexts, and the same ones I would not, and you would not in others. And so I think that's painting with a very broad brush.
In Psalm 82, that you raised as being a reference to these gods, could you explain how these gods had judged unjustly and shown partiality to the wicked?
Do I know all the specifics behind that verse? No, I certainly don't know all the context behind that verse.
Okay, all right. Now, if I understand the position that you are enunciating then, Dr. Tanner, you were asking me if I would agree with the LDS that men can become gods.
I didn't say that. I was just asking if you believe the concept that men can become gods. I didn't ask if you believed with the LDS. I would never ask that question.
Okay. Well, however you stated the specific question, you were in essence saying, well, the debate is, can men become gods, a Protestant LDS debate. Is it not a fair statement, Dr. Tanner, that within the LDS context, when we speak of God, we are speaking of an exalted man?
I think that is the general belief, yes.
Okay. And would you not say that it's fair in the early church context that Athanasius was not referring to God as an exalted man?
No, I do not. I think that every Christian who believes that Jesus was crucified and resurrected and is an exalted man and is God believes to an extent that God is an exalted man. Not in the same context that Latter-day Saints do, but they do believe that concept.
Did Athanasius believe that Jesus had eternally been God?
I think that's something that he would believe, yes.
And did Athanasius ever speak of God the Father as an exalted man?
No, he did not. That is a prime distinction, I think, between Latter-day Saints, early Christians, and Protestants, is that belief.
In fact, would you agree with the conclusion of Dr. Norman? I'm sure you're familiar with his doctoral dissertation, where he says, Athanasius's constant emphasis on participation or deification by grace as opposed to nature safeguards against both polytheism on the one hand and pantheism on the other. The deified Christian is never equal to God in essence and remains subordinate by nature, nor is one identified with God so as to lose his individual consciousness or activity. The difference for Athanasius between Christ and the Christian is that what the Savior possesses, phusai kai aletheia, by nature, truly by nature, the saved attains thesai kai charity. They're emphasizing the concept of a gift of grace. Would you agree with Norman at that point?
I would agree with Norman and with Latter-day Saints that there's not one of us who is a Latter-day Saint that believes that men can become gods other than by grace.
So when we read Joseph Smith and his statement that we have to learn to dwell in everlasting burnings and learn how to become gods that all the gods have learned before us in the King Follett Funeral Discourse, would you not agree with me that that is a context completely foreign to that of Athanasius? He would have had no way of understanding what Joseph Smith was saying.
Absolutely not. I think one of the great distinctions between the Protestant world today and the early Christians is on whom God will choose to bestow this greatest of all gifts. There is a belief that's rampant now that if you just believe, that gift will be bestowed upon you. The early church fathers had a very common saying, we don't think great thoughts, we do great things. The emphasis was on doing what Christ said, doing what Christ taught, and to those who obey him, he would grant by grace that great gift.
But is it then still your assertion, however, that Athanasius, with his doctrine of who God the Father was, having been eternally God, that Athanasius would have understood the words of Joseph Smith, that we have to learn how to become gods as God himself learned how to become a god? Would he have agreed with Joseph Smith?
Oh, I see. As God, no, I don't think Athanasius would have believed that there was a time when God, the Father, was a man.
Okay, thank you.
There is the cross-examination period of the deification debate with Martin Tanner. You can obtain that debate on our website. The MP3 list is updated and ready to go. You can order the audio tapes and the video as well. It fits perfectly into a Bible study class setting, by the way, so you might want to pick that up. Thank you for listening today. Thank you for listening even to the difficult stuff earlier on. Pray for us as we continue planning for the next outreach in Salt Lake City. Thanks for listening to The Dividing Line. God bless.
Has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-0318 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracts. Join us again next Saturday afternoon at 2 p.m. for The Dividing Line.